Hello and welcome to Delete, Delete, Engage, the podcast supercharging engagement at work with tips and insights from some of the world's finest communicators. My latest podcast guest, Graham Johnson, is the Group Director of Talent, Leadership and Learning at Merlin Entertainments, the company behind visitor attractions and theme parks such as Legoland, Alton Towers, Cadbury World, Madame Tussauds and the London Eye. Graham's career has evolved from attracting talent to developing talent during stints at Accenture, Virgin Media, where we briefly worked together, BT Group, Entain, and now Merlin Entertainments. Graham and I chat about the secrets of a strong employer brand and value proposition, the importance of showing your true culture, warts and all, to the outside world, the leadership traits recruiters are looking for in job interviews, the ingredients of a successful leadership event, shifting the development focus from the top 10% to more democratized learning, and the importance of recruiting and developing neurodiverse talent. Enjoy the podcast. Graham, welcome to Delete, Delete, Engage. Now, your career has evolved from attracting talent to developing talent and leadership. And I'd like to talk about both of those areas and also the challenges some businesses might have with walking the talk when it comes to living up to their employer brand image. You up for that?
Yeah, sounds good. Great to be here. Thanks, you.
So let's start with employer brand and how a business goes about attracting and inspiring talent. What are the secrets of a strong employer brand, would you say?
Secrets of employer brand. I think there's probably three things that I always look for and in the work that I've done with teams in the past on employer brand. And it must stand out in the marketplace. So have a certain point of view and be worthy of comment. It must be truthful. So, and I think more so in the last 10 years where employer brands evolved from being trying to sell based on benefits to actually like pulling back the cover and letting people see inside and see the harsh realities. Mm. And then the third thing, I think it must be compelling enough to make people want to act. So whether that's engage with you, have a conversation with you. So those are the three ingredients that I look for in employer brands that I've developed in Virgin, in BT, and in the other couple of businesses that I've worked in.
So just talking about that sort of truthful element you mentioned, because that's key, isn't it? Otherwise, it's not authentic. So just, you know, from your time in Virgin Media and BT Group, could you share a little bit about the brand traits that you tapped into for your recruitment advertising to make sure it was truthful and authentic?
Yeah, well, starting with Virgin, it was really interesting. Like, we didn't have a problem attracting volume of applicants for roles. Broadly speaking, we were a destination because of the pull of the Virgin brand. The challenge that we had was managing expectations, and it was a gritty commercial telco business, fantastic culture, and we would sell on the culture, but we would also explain the harsh realities of what a sales role involved, what an engineering role involved, and quite often it wouldn't be what people expected. So we spent a lot of time trying to manage expectations and give people sort of the realities of the role, whether it be, look, you're going to, you know, do 18 visits in a day if you're an engineer, or we do door-to-door sales roles. We've got some gritty retail roles where it's target-driven, you know, so don't expect to bump into Richard Branson at the coffee machine is one of the stories that we used to tell.
Yeah. You mentioned then that maybe when people join Virgin, it's not always exactly what they expect. Yeah. Something I talk about a lot on social media is the engagement gap, which is kind of the gap between the carefully curated employer brand that people see on the outside, talent sees on the outside, versus maybe the harsh realities on the inside. I recently spoke to an HR director at a prestigious retail store who said that they've got trouble holding on to retail talent because they feel the employee working environment doesn't always match up to the VIP customer experience. Mm-hmm. And it's sometimes a bit of a surprise to them. You know, is that something that you've experienced then in your job, you know, setting out this employer brand and then seeing people maybe not quite surprised at the way it's been sold to them?
Yeah, absolutely. In every business that I've worked in the one that I'm in now, actually, it's interesting. All of the investment goes into product and it goes into the front of house experience. You know, in the theme park world, that's what we spend our capital on. So often the back office isn't as glamorous. And I think in Virgin, the key is in my experience, is getting the recruitment team and the line managers who play a role in hiring and attracting people to talk through the harsh realities and to actually use that as an advantage to say, look, if you're up for a challenge to come and fix some of the problems that we have, then this will be the role for you. So to use the, in the way that like some of the greatest Hollywood films do this, it's like, it's part of a journey or you're on a quest to improve something. Mm. That's the narrative or the story that we would use. And I think the most skillful recruiters are great storytellers, and they'll position something as, yes, there's a glamorous brand and reputation and we do fantastic things from a customer experience point of view, but actually behind the scenes it's tough and here are the harsh realities and you can be part of fixing them. And I think that'll compel some people to apply, and it'll put off people who wouldn't be suitable for the environment anyway.
Yeah, that's a great answer. You were talking earlier on about kind of the importance of selling or telling a story about what it's like to work somewhere versus just reeling off the benefits that you'll get.
Yeah.
Now, those benefits would generally come under what's known as an EVP, right? Now, for those people who don't know what an EVP is, would you mind explaining to them and what would maybe make a good one?
Yeah. So I think of EVP as like the give and the get. So it's the employment, it's the social contract you have with an employee to say, look, here's what we expect and here's what we'll give you in return.
Yeah.
And to be really clear about how that is different for certain roles in the business, you might have an overarching value proposition for the business, but then diving into what does that mean for an engineer? What are the standards we expect and what will you get in return? What does that mean for sales, retail, et cetera? So yeah. The give and the get is how I think about it.
And it stands for employee value proposition, doesn't it?
Yes. Yeah.
So when a company is looking to develop an EVP, how would they go about doing that? What would you be looking for? Are you simply looking at, well, we're prepared to offer this in return for this, or is there more to it than that?
I think there's much more to it. I would go digging for the gold dust, like how I describe it. Like go and find the stories in the business and do your research. So interestingly enough, I've just spent the last 18 months researching and working on the Merlin Entertainment's EVP, where we've gone out to frontline teams, we've gone to senior leaders, we've gone to middle management, we've looked at different global perspectives and different regional nuances of the business, and we're researching, spend a good chunk of time hearing from our people what it's really like to work here and what are the challenges and what are the benefits. And then package that research up into, so you go through a discovery phase, pull out the key themes and distill that down into, okay, for these audiences, this is what we say about ourselves. And this is the message that we want to get out in the marketplace.
Mm. And just talking a little bit about Merlin Entertainments and kind of the structure of the business and what it does. So obviously it's a kind of a visitor attraction and theme park focused business, isn't it? And you've got a number of brands within the stable, haven't you? So could you just talk to me a little bit about how the business is sort of set up?
Yeah, we do. I mean, it's a huge, fantastic business. It's theme parks and attractions. There's three parts to it. So we own Legoland parks. We have 10 of those and two under construction in China. So we'll have 12 in the next 2 years. We have our theme park division, of which we have five. So there's one in Germany, one in Italy, and a few in the UK. Thorpe, Chessington, Alton Towers will be ones that you may be familiar with. And then we have what we call a midway business, which is like cluster attractions generally built around an observatory like the London Eye. And then we'll have a few attractions that are in that footfall area. So it's quite a simple business. And it's huge, and we've got around about 150 attractions and parks around the world.
Mm-hmm. And so when you're kind of looking to hire talent, are you advertising the attraction, or are you advertising the employer brand, the sort of the Merlin Entertainments element?
We use both. I think for in Legoland, for example, like Lego is a big draw, so we'll use that. You're going to get to come and help bring Lego to life for families and for children, and that's part of the draw there. But we also, like the counter or the balance to that is, like, it's hard work, it's outdoors, you'll be working in the rain, you'll be working in the car park, you'll be working across different roles within a park, and we look for emotional intelligence. And actually, that's probably one of the most important ingredients that we look for and we test for. So again, we try and get the balance of, it's not all fun and glamorous, it is hard work, and this is where you could go in the business, you're part of a bigger, you know, bigger proposition. If you want a career in Merlin, you can move around the world and go and work in different visitor attractions, but we try and be realistic about the challenges in the role as well as the glamour of the brand.
Yeah, yeah. And do you get to travel around the world and try the different attractions out?
I do, actually, yeah. I mean, I was fortunate enough to spend the first 12 months. You have to really get to the front line and experience the attractions to understand the business. And fortunately, in London, I've been at Dungeons and Shrek and London Eye and Alton Towers and all these businesses. But yeah, I've been to the US. Got 3 Legoland parks in the US, which I've visited all of them. And it's been an interesting sort of, I'm up to 2 years now in Merlin, and I've probably only seen about a third of the business.
Right, yeah, that's fascinating. So you started your career kind of attracting talent, and your role now has kind of moved more into developing talent. It would seem obvious, but why is developing existing talent so important to a business?
If you think about it from a communication perspective, and I was thinking on the journey in about the concept of engagement, the number one channel of communication and biggest source of engagement is line managers. So for me, development's fascinating because get to work, I've worked with line managers attracting people into the business, and then it's now how they look after their people, how they communicate, how they tell stories, how they engage their teams. So I think it's fundamentally important. Gallup have done a ton of research around what's going to be the future of work. And their concept is it's all about the manager, how good they are as that, challenging up, managing expectations down. So that's the bit that I get to play with and fascinates me at the moment.
Yeah. I mean, it's going to be quite a challenge, I guess, isn't it? Because, thinking about, just going back and thinking a little bit about employer brand and what that stands for and the culture of the business, because you can promote a certain culture, but you can argue that you're enjoyment or your engagement at work is largely down to your manager, right? If the culture that they promote or help to cultivate isn't something that you feel like you belong as part of, that's a problem, isn't it?
It's a huge problem.
An individual challenge in that regard.
Yeah, I mean, it's in a lot of the research and in my personal experience, it's what draws you into work in an organization, also what keeps you like sustainably engaged over a period of time. So I think line manager's role is crucial. Disney describe it as like the frozen middle, which often gets neglected in terms of development. So it's a big focus for us. We know that I was interested in listening to one of your previous podcasts where you're talking about emails and channels of comms. Like the line manager is the channel of communications that needs the work.
Yeah, and so, I mean, communications, I would think, is probably quite an important part of good leadership, right? Because some leaders, and I've experienced it myself within a business, thinking of a CEO is the most obvious example. Some have a natural aptitude towards being a good orator or a good speaker and can command a crowd and all that kind of thing. Others maybe not. They maybe struggle a bit more. Is that a skill that you look for, and how do you then go about developing that skill?
It is a skill we look for, and it's also like very developable.
Yes.
The ability to engage a team through just being optimistic, being positive, having the emotional radar of how are the team feeling and sensing what's going on with the team, it is a skill that can be learned. And I think the other kind of underdeveloped area is storytelling. So you can take a scenario of, yes, there might be challenges, and here are all the challenges going on, but here's the way through it, and here's what we need from you as a team. Like to see the hope, like leaders are peddlers of hope, is the famous quote, and I think that's the piece that can be taught to introverts, extroverts, people who are good at storytelling or not. There's tools and mechanics that we can give to leaders, and I think that's the bit that needs to be developed in businesses.
Yeah, it's interesting. Previous guest of mine, Ronan Dunn, who was the former CEO of O2, he described himself as kind of the chief storyteller. He felt that was a really, really important part of his role. There's another CEO that I've worked with in the past who, with each new internal campaign, he would tell a personal story to set that campaign on its way. So, for example, it was a financial services business. They were running a campaign about fraud, and he told a very personal story about how he was the victim of fraud as an 11 or 12 year old. And it just means that that thing lodges in your brain in a far more effective way.
100%. I mean, we've just completed a leadership event at the start of the year, and we have our leaders are actually like faculty and teachers within our business. And we, two stories really stick out for me. We've got Rex Jackson, who's the president of our North American Legoland Parks, who stood on a stage with a group of people, was very vulnerable and talked about how he failed as a child, how he failed at school, failed at college, and connected with other people in the audience who felt the same. And then we had our creative director who was unpacking the science of happiness and described how like she wasn't happy as a child and how she went on a journey to figure out how to become happier. So it just like disarms them as leaders. And I think it's a massively underdeveloped skill that we're really focusing on now.
I guess that's something that's probably changed, isn't it, over the last, I don't know, 20 or 30 years, is that I guess in the past, leaders wouldn't want to show that softer emotional side. They would want to come across as a heroic figure, maybe, whereas maybe that's something that's happening a little bit more now.
I think so. And it's a bit back to the start of the conversation about what good employer brands do. It's actually to be more vulnerable, to be more open and honest, and to show the truth, because people see through it, and the sort of corporate veneer of what used to be pushed out in the marketplace maybe 15, 20 years ago just isn't accepted anymore. And I think that's the same for leaders. You know, people want to see the stories of failure. They want to be able to identify with the leader. And if that leader's constantly putting on a sort of an image of everything's okay, it's not necessarily what people would believe in or would follow.
Yeah. I guess, though, I might be putting you on the spot a little bit with this one, but I guess leaders are possibly quite comfortable with talking about past challenges, weaknesses. They don't often admit to a current challenge or weakness, right? That's rare. It usually ends up with, well, I came from this, but I'm now this. You know, there was a positive end. Do we hear that at all? Do leaders ever kind of, you know, open up about what's going on right now?
Yeah, that's a fascinating question. I think those that are in tune with what the audience needs to hear do.
Yeah.
And our current chief executive actually did it very recently to say, look, here's some challenges that we're facing. Here's what I'm worried about in this next 12 months. And so here's why I'm going to make some decisions. And actually, for the first time in probably maybe going back to Virgin days when I think our chief executive, Neil, did it at a moment in time that I remember. I think it's rare, but I think it's really powerful when they do.
Now, we tend to think about leadership development as kind of the people that are going to go all the way to the top, to the C-suite. Are you just focused on that, or are you looking at talent throughout the business?
Yep, throughout the business, we're moving from what was quite a traditional hierarchical approach to leadership, concentrate on, you know, the top 10%, to actually democratizing learning. So we've got a framework which is about everybody should understand themselves, like leading self is our key thing that we put everybody through. And then we do have curriculum that everybody has access to. We're moving away from hierarchy to almost like if you imagine the London Eye as a visual framework, where we take people through like leading self, leading people, business and enterprise. And it's available for everyone. So that's the shift that we're making at the moment in leadership development.
Okay. And how do you spot leadership potential?
I think there's a few, probably three things that I would look for. And having interviewed thousands of people early career, you tend to focus on, can they make good decisions? Will they be able to influence others? And probably the most important one is, do they have the drive? Like this thing around like ambition. Is there evidence of that you can see where they've overcome adversity, or they've just got the bit between their teeth and they've got this grit and drive to get things done? Because quite often, in spite of whatever other skills they might need to develop, that's the thing that'll get them there. I'd class it as decision-making, influence and drive.
Yeah. And just wanted to ask you about that kind of, you know, you mentioned that you've interviewed hundreds, thousands of people over the years. What can people do to improve their chances of coming across well to you in an interview, from a leadership perspective?
That's a great question. There's sort of attributes and qualities that you look for in evidence of achievement, and I think chemistry and emotional connections always important, and to be able to be self-assured, be composed, be able to be present, answer questions. I mean, that's actually quite an underrated skill in an interview, to be able to get to the point really, you know, in a concise way and a compelling way. That would stand out for me.
Okay. Is there space for neurodiversity at leadership? Because obviously our traditional view of a leader is, you know, male or female, but they can hold an audience. They're, you know, they're influential. They can speak well. They've got a certain gravitas and personality. Some people just simply don't have that, right? And is that changing? And how do you find space for that?
Yeah, I think so. I think not only is there space for it, like, we should be in search of it. There's a couple of really great leaders, including our chief executive, actually, who talks about how he has ADHD and talks about what that means and some of the traits that you'll see in him and why. And equally, we have a marketing director who does the same. So I think you need brave people to talk about it and show how they use it as their superpower and how that means they can perform at a different level. And BT was a fascinating one, actually. We had some amazing like technologists and great stories of people who BT couldn't have achieved what it did in BT Sport and in the technology division without people who had incredible skills that would be probably classified as, you know, being on the spectrum.
Now, in terms of planning a leadership development program and putting myself in your shoes here, how important is it that you have, because you're going to have businesses, you're going to have FTSE 100 businesses that you would think would have a big budget for this kind of thing. And maybe you've got much smaller businesses where they're operating on a shoestring. How important is budget to ensuring that leaders are developed in the right way?
It always helps. I think it depends on the objectives. Always start with the end in mind with a group. And you can do the simplest things, like we give like experiences in a box to teams to go, okay, if you want to achieve these three outcomes, here's what you can do in 30 minutes with a team on a call, and here's how you could run a session, up to, you know, flagship experiences in a park where we would want to like keep energy levels high and we would want to focus on certain topics and unpack them in workshops. So I think you can do it at various different scales. It's just about being intentional about what you're trying to cause and being really clear about the outcomes.
And there are some talent within an organization that just simply doesn't want to lead a team, right? They're important to the success of the organization. They play a really important role, but maybe they're not, being a manager is something that they just don't want to do. How do you kind of manage that sort of, I mean, because there will be people in every organization that tick that box, right?
Yeah, definitely. I think it's about understanding. It comes back to line managers having a really good sense of what they need in their teams. And is it people who will fulfill a certain role, and actually ambition isn't necessarily important, and just identifying where that's good, where that's healthy, where that's okay, and actually celebrating people for that. And the business that I'm in, we have a really nice balance of some frontline people who've do incredible work, like the gardener in Alton Towers has been there like for 30 years and does a brilliant job and is really proud. And we celebrate that. And like Mick, who works on the door at Alton Towers as well, like his role is to greet families and to remember families. And he's been doing that for sort of 15 years. And we value that and actually celebrate it. And I think that's important.
Yeah. And so do you have that? I mean, you were talking earlier about stories and people's stories when we were talking a bit more about employer brand. Yeah. Do you have a lot of that then across your organization of those people like me?
Oh, we have tons. I mean, it's like in businesses that are consumer facing, guest facing, you're absolutely flooded with them. And even going back to Virgin days, this one I remember, which was an engineer called Paul, actually, who was in the Midlands. You might remember the story. Who went into a customer's home. They'd been complaining for weeks and weeks and phoning up the call center and saying that the Virgin box was broken, to the point where we actually just sent an engineer out to help, and the TV was broken. Paul kind of, you know, went and sourced a TV. It was Christmas time and bought a new TV for the customer, went up, you know, beyond what he needed to do. And that was one example where we're like, look, that's amazing service, like heartfelt service, we used to describe it as. And that was celebrated and became legend story. I think it was kind of blown up on social media at the time.
It was picked up by the press, I think,
it was,
wasn't it?
Actually, yeah. So look, that's the power of like a genuine, truthful story about somebody who's just gone above and beyond in their role and lived the values of the business. And yeah, we've got tons of them in Merlin. I think we're blessed with them being in a guest-facing experience business.
Yeah. During my time working in-house, leading employee engagement, the biggest events of the year were often the strategic leadership conferences or offsites. Now, you recently posted a piece on LinkedIn about impactful leadership experiences. That's right. I got that right, didn't I?
Yeah.
And I think you wrote that after running a particularly successful leadership event at Merlin Entertainment. So what is the secret to a great leadership event? What should people be looking to do? Because I'm sure people get flummoxed a lot about where to start.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know if I have the secret. What I would say about the experience that we put on, it was 350 leaders in a park in Gardaland in Italy who had never been together in person before. The build-up to the experience was we were going to launch new values and we were going to unpack some fundamental like basics for leadership around coaching and feedback and mindset. So one of the things we benefited from was it had never been done before with this group. So there was a real demand for it. There was an excitement for it. And also what they'd come from was probably events that were on a smaller scale, sitting back in an audience and listening to like click through presentations, and then there'll be a social element to it. So we're taking them from an experience that they'd never had before to something that was radically different. We also made it about them. So there was no external involvement. All of the facilitators of workshops were existing leaders in the business who also had never done it before. So it was a bit like, you know, going along to a wedding and, you know, you're cheering on the best man's speech. Mm. So there was this sense of we want the leader to be successful in running this workshop and we're kind of there with them. We kept the content like interesting, exciting. We used a model which was tell a personal story. Have a framework that you can teach people, but then get to an exercise quickly so we get people on their feet, or, you know, they were drawing, or we even had a piece which was about finding your expertise and owning your craft and becoming the world's expert in the thing that you're great at. And we had a finance director who was teaching people dance moves for a few minutes. You know, so there was a fun element to
it. Did you know beforehand that he was going to do this?
Well, we actually decided it the night before.
Right.
So we were in the room with Scott, our chief exec, and we were going through each of the workshops and making tweaks and changes. And we're like, Ed, you know what would make a real difference? Mm. If you put some sort of energetic thing in there, teach them some dance moves. Mm. And he was deeply uncomfortable, but then did a brilliant job. Mm. So yeah, I think, you know, putting people at the center of it, understanding what they need, making it fun, high energy. Workshops were 45 minutes and there was lots of movement and some free time. And I think we went through 21 different versions of design and the build up to it. So yeah, there was real attention to detail. And we did it as a team, you know, cross cultures. We worked with a local Italian team and they put their sort of cultural influence into it. And some of the things we did brought the spirit of Italy into the event. Mm. Yeah, I was proud of it. It was great fun.
No, it sounds fantastic. And what sounds really quite nice about that is, I guess it's an opportunity sometimes for leaders to let a little bit of their guard down in front of their peers, right? So you maybe see a little bit more of the personality that they have outside of work.
Yeah.
And I just wonder whether that's something that, should we be seeing more of that in the workplace itself, where people are, and I know when we tend to talk about bringing our whole selves to work, it's often as part of a diversity and inclusion program or narrative. You know, how much does it apply more generally to the way that leaders and managers should be in the workplace?
Yeah, 100%. I mean, I think if I think of the leaders that have engaged me personally over the years, they've always been like, there's been a vulnerability, there's been a fun element to it. You've been with them through like good times and bad times, wearing their heart on their sleeve and being more vulnerable. I think it is the key to unlocking performance in a team who also feel I can do the same. Yeah, I think it's super important.
Mm. One of the reasons I started this podcast was because although I've worked in internal comms and employee engagement for a long time, I recognize that there's lots of things I don't know. And there are lots of people with specialist expertise that I just don't have. And I'm fascinated about that and what's happening and how that's developing. In your world, how do you, you know, do you have that sort of curiosity and how do you sort of stay innovative and stay on top of what's going on and new ideas and that kind of thing?
Yeah, I do. I mean, I'm in development, so, and the fact that I've gone into a learning and leadership role, yeah, I think is because of a passion that I have to, you know, be curious and learn certain subjects. I'm fascinated by storytelling. So that's a sort of research passion point for me. And also the thing that I'm building at the moment is like a corporate university concept within Merlin. So where I've gone for inspiration there is to look at Union Square Hospitality Group in the US. Like, they run leadership development for other businesses. And they're a restaurant business who say, essentially, it's not the food that's important, it's the hospitality experience. Mm-hmm. So I've met with that group and understand, like, what's their science and formula behind understanding what hospitality is. I've been at the Disney Institute in Florida and looked at how they teach guest experience and what can we learn from them. So I'm always looking outside of the business to think about ways that we can not replicate what others do, but just use that as input to kind of spark creativity and imagination and what could we do that would be relevant for the context and the business that we run.
So there's a well-worn saying that people don't leave their company, they leave their manager, right? So talent sometimes can be brilliant, but they can also be jerks, right? How important is that? Can you help develop that if people naturally have a way of winding people up the wrong way? And how much of a problem is it when people don't have that sort of emotional intelligence and empathy?
Yeah, I like to believe that you can develop it and it can change. And I think it comes down to self-awareness. It's what we teach people when they join our business currently. Do you understand yourself? Are you open to feedback? Can you take what people say about you and use that as input and change? That said, in the 21 years of my career, there's only been one example where I've come across someone who couldn't change despite lots of feedback. Was just closed off to it. And sadly, you know, my reaction to that was to leave the business. So I think, you know, it definitely can, but it starts with awareness, self-awareness, and being willing to change.
Yeah. And I guess with self-awareness, then that can lead on to lots of other development opportunities. Yeah. If you understand where your weaknesses are. Right?
Absolutely. And what we, you know, the interesting example right now live in Merlin is part of the business is saying, like, look, we need to teach people these procedures, like how to do disciplinaries, how to do performance reviews. And like, we can't do any of that until we do leading self, like getting people to understand who they are as a leader, teach them some fundamentals about how to lead a team for the first time before we give them the operating manual and the policies and procedures. Like, we've got to leave that stuff, the task stuff, until after people fundamentally understand who they are.
And can people develop leadership capability later in life? Because we tend to think that these people were always destined for the top. But what about those people that maybe have muddled and struggled along for years, but then find a new confidence or hit their stride later in life? Is that possible, do you think?
100%. You're the subject of the things you experience. Mm. So, you know, whether you might find a leader that emerge later, like late bloomers, go through some tough times and come through that, and then have actually learned something, have some battle scars, and can be a greater leader as a result of that. I think you have to have the drive and the desire to be a leader, but we are the subject of our experiences. So I think it's absolutely, that can happen at any point in life.
Graham, thank you. Really, really enjoyed that. That was great. Now, before we wrap up, I ask each of my podcast guests to answer 6 quick-fire comms-related questions in around 90 seconds, all right? So, you know, if it takes longer, that's fine, but try and be instinctive. Okay. You all right with that?
I'll go for it, yeah.
Sum up your communication style in 3 words.
Passionate, excitable, concise.
Of all the comms you receive or emails you get, roughly what percentage do you delete without reading?
70%.
What was the last message that landed in your inbox that really grabbed your attention?
My internal comms partner who swore and also asked me how many newsletters are there in this business.
And the answer was?
Too many.
Too many. In your opinion, what's the one thing a business can do to boost engagement?
Give the line managers the skills to be great storytellers.
What makes a good communicator?
Good listening skills, empathy.
Which communicator, alive or dead, do you most admire?
Viv McSweeney.
She's Harrods employer brand.
Yeah, she is. My old boss. Well, she inspired me. She's my mentor. That's where I got it all from.
Fantastic. Graham, thank you so much.
Pleasure.
That's wonderful.
Thanks, you.
Thanks for listening to today's podcast. I hope you enjoyed it. If you'd like to hear more from Delete Delete Engage, including live updates and early access to each podcast episode, why not sign up to the newsletter at deletedeleteengage.substack.com.